politician touring America in 1852 was dismayed to discover that Americans rejected the unofficial uniforms of class. In Europe, there was the peasant girl with the gaudy ribbons interlaced in her long tresses, her bright corset, and her richly folded petticoat. There, the Hungarian peasant with his white linen shirt and his stately sheepskin. The Slovak in the closely fitting jacket and the bright yellow buttons. The farmer with the high boots and the Hungarian coat. The old women with black lace cap in the ancient national style. And none but the young ladies appareled in French bonnets and modern dresses. But in New York, he complained, no characteristical costumes mark here the different grades of society which in Eastern Europe impress the foreigner at once with the varied occupations and habits of an old country. Before the end of the 19th century, Daniel J. Boorstin writes, the American democracy of clothing would become still more astonishing to foreign eyes, for by then the mere wearing of clothes would be an instrument of community, a way of drawing immigrants into a new life. Men whose ancestors had been accustomed to the peasant's tatters or the craftsman's leather apron could show by a democratic costume that they were as good as, or not very different from, the next man. If, as the old world proverb went, clothes make the man, the new world's new way of clothing would help make new men. Boorstin chronicles how the very idea of income was reinvented in the New World. Before the 19th century, the concept of income had very little importance in the Old World. It was used indirectly to measure property ownership or stake in the community or as a basis for election reform. In Europe and virtually everywhere else, the important metric was property ownership, specifically land. Because that was the measure by which the state and the society assigned status. In America, where nearly everyone was an immigrant or the recent descendant of an immigrant, wealth had become disassociated with inherited status or nobility. Among mobile Americans, a nation of recent immigrants moving from one place to another, up and down the social scale, income was a more convenient and more universally applicable standard of measurement than wealth or property. Income was as close as one could come to quantifying the standard of living, and it provided a simple way of telling who was above or below the standard. Even the concept of standard of living took on new meaning in America because that standard was constantly and rapidly improving for nearly everyone. This explosive growth owed much to plentiful natural resources, especially land. But the indispensable ingredient was, and always has been, people. In this case, a certain kind of individual and specific class of people, the entrepreneur and the bourgeoisie. In Europe, the entrepreneur aroused fear and distrust. Again, innovation had a negative connotation throughout Europe and much of the world until the late 18th and early 19th centuries. In England and Holland, business innovators, like scientific ones, were more honored than anywhere else in the old world. But in the new world, the inventor became a hero. Likewise, in England and Holland, the middle-class merchant was more respected than anywhere else on the continent. But in America, the whole country was being built around a fundamentally bourgeois worldview. The middle class and those who strive to be in it for the first time had a government that reflected their interests and aspirations. In the old world, the right to form a legal corporation was entrenched in politics and status. It was a special privilege akin to being granted a title to land. In America, Boorstin writes, the corporation was democratized by being made a standardized product, available to anyone who followed the simple steps prescribed and paid a small registration fee. Now, as Boorstin notes, instead of businessmen anxiously seeking the special privilege of incorporation, the states competed for the favors of businessmen. the enticements offered by land speculators, city boosters, and railroad promoters to natural persons and their families were matched by enticements to these artificial persons. The old iron triumvirate of class, guild, and throne that made economic advancement an act of rebellion against the status quo had been overthrown. It is a testament to how largely the legacy of slavery hangs over our thinking today that it is difficult to write any of this without constantly offering the balefully accurate caveat, except for blacks, and to a lesser extent, except for women. It is an entirely accurate point. But as discussed earlier, slavery was a nearly universal human institution across the world and throughout the ages. Against the yardstick of the present, at least in the democratic liberal West, every advance in human liberty fails to measure up. My point here is not to justify or diminish the evil of slavery or Jim Crow. It is simply to argue that we should read the chapters in human history in their correct order. The American Revolution, as Barack Obama has argued, unleashed a new argument for new principles that, when carried to their moral and logical conclusion, commanded the end of slavery and Jim Crow. No one can argue that it shouldn't have happened sooner or not have been necessary in the first place. But the principles we invoke to condemn the past for its misdeeds are the very principles that the past bequeathed to us. In the century and a half following the Revolution, America experienced the greatest run-up in material prosperity of any nation in human history. In the four decades from 1860 to 1900, our population more than doubled from 31 million to 76 million. When Daniel Webster died in 1852, America was a third as wealthy as Great Britain. 5 decades later, it had grown fivefold, with America 1.25 times richer than the British. From 1890 to 1910, the U.S. GNP grew at 6% a year. According to historian Burton W. Folsom, Jr., in 1870, America was creating 23% of the world's industrial goods, while Britain and Germany produced 30 and 13% respectively. By 1900, America was in first place with 30%, Britain fell to 20%, and Germany rose to 20%. In 1870, Britain was the world's chief steel producer. By 1900, Andrew Carnegie alone made more steel than all of Great Britain. In 1775, real GDP per capita was $1,968.24. By 1820, it was $2,173.78. By 1929, it was $11,020.48. Life expectancy rose by leaps and bounds. Work weeks became shorter. Diets improved. In the old world, beef was the diet of lords and men of wealth. For others, it was a holiday prize. But American millions would eat like lords, writes Daniel Boorstin. America defied the Malthusian curse that bedeviled societies for all of human history. Even as its population exploded, it got richer even faster. But while the miracle repealed Malthus's law of population, it did not repeal human nature. The natural tendency of man to form coalitions, factions, guilds, and aristocracies manifested itself continually throughout American history. But the combined power of the constitutional order and sheer economic growth tended to keep it at bay. We'll return to that later. One last point needs to be made here. The triumph of the miracle in America isn't merely a story about economics or law. The economics are important because that is the measurement of human material improvement. It is also the chief metric that many of those who despise and revile capitalism invest with the most moral authority. It must be said again and again, the free market is the greatest anti-poverty program in all of human history. In a very real sense, it is the only anti-poverty program in all of human history. The legal system is important because it provides the guardrails for continuing human improvement. But focusing on economics gives short shrift to another kind of entrepreneurialism that America unleashed upon the world more than any other nation. The entrepreneurialism of the self. The pursuit of happiness is not inherently or exclusively economic. It is much bigger than that. America's culture of liberty, its legal doctrines of natural rights, and perhaps most of all, its staggering material prosperity, made it possible for the masses to define happiness on personal and individual terms, to earn their own success as they defined it. This fact is a double-edged sword. For by removing the idea of external authority like never before and exalting the sovereignty of the personal, we have opened a door for human nature to come rushing back in. Part 3. 7. The elites. Aristocrats unchained. As we've seen, the American founders believed that the enemy of liberty was arbitrary power. They rejected a line of thought that stretches from Plato's Republic through Rousseau's social contract to any number of modern ideologies that men, the right men, disinterested men, could be trusted with unchecked power. George Washington was the most admired man in America at the time of the founding, and the office of the presidency was in many ways molded around the granite edifice of his reputation for honor and good character. And yet, the founders still placed enormous checks on the president's power, because they knew that a George Washington would not always be on the ballot. In theory, the threat of concentrated power falling into the hands of a few people or a single person, be it an aristocracy, caste, guild, star chamber, priesthood, or even some elective despotism, was foreclosed with the ratification of the Constitution. But not all of the founders were entirely optimistic that the experiment would work. First, they believed the system could work only if the public remained virtuous, for the good character of the people is the best guarantor of fidelity to the law. John Adams worried that the people themselves might, in some populist fervor, seek to overthrow limited government. This would be made even more likely if the people turned away from virtue and, in turn, liberty. As Washington said, "Arbitrary power is most easily established on the ruins of liberty abused to licentiousness." More than any other founder, Adams was worried about the possibility that aristocracy, perhaps under some other name, could return. Establishing a nation where ambition is set against ambition almost by definition invites people to strain against any external impediments to their objectives. Men naturally form coalitions or factions, and who is to say some coalition couldn't get enough power to overwhelm the constitutional order? Jefferson wanted a natural aristocracy of merit, but was it not possible, if not inevitable, that after having climbed the ladder of merit to the heights of power, that same natural aristocracy would then pull the ladder up behind them? This is precisely what John Adams feared. A natural aristocracy may yield a body of men which contains the greatest collection of virtues and abilities in a free government, is the brightest ornament and glory of the nation, and may always be made the greatest blessing of society. But, he noted, it must be judiciously managed in the Constitution, because when such constitutional management fails, it is always the most dangerous, nay, it may be added, it never fails to be the destruction of the Commonwealth. Every government is an aristocracy in fact, Adams argued in a letter to Benjamin Rush, and it may contain men of great but dark talents. The solution lay in recognizing and planning for this reality. The great secret of liberty is to find means to limit the aristocrats' power and control their passions. I can never too often repeat that aristocracy is the monster to be chained, he said, yet so chained as not to be hurt, for he is a most useful and necessary animal in his place. Nothing can be done without him. Bind aristocracy then with a double cord. Shut him up in a cage from which, however, he may be let out to do good, but never to do mischief. If you like the idea of putting the aristocrats in a dungeon of some kind, you will be disappointed. The cage Adams had in mind was the United States Senate. He had as his guide the practices of Britain and ancient Rome, each of which had a higher legislative body of nobles whose role and power were clearly delineated in a mixed regime. He did not want to have a House of Lords comprising hereditary nobles, but did not rule out the possibility that it might be necessary. Fortunately, we never felt the need to formally restore hereditary aristocracy, but it is clear that Adams and others were deeply concerned about the possibility, if not the inevitability, of a return to aristocracy. Theoretically, it wouldn't be impossible, but the founders thought that this liberty-loving people might one day re-embrace aristocracy despite its being entirely prohibited by the Constitution and totally discredited in the hearts and minds of the people. Why? A simple answer. They were right. Aristocracies are natural. To understand this, we need to get past the word aristocracy. It clangs off the modern ear precisely because we so completely associate it with earlier times. And while lords and earls are fit for medieval history and Game of Thrones fans, those are not the only forms of aristocracy. It might be better to simply refer to elites or ruling classes. The terms aren't all completely synonymous, of course, but they can come far closer to being interchangeable than people often realize. In North Korea, the party elite would be instantly recognizable as aristocrats or nobles to a time traveler or alien visitor. They have special rights and privileges and live in special areas reserved for the ruling class. Indeed, in any communist country, members of the party are simply a modern form of an aristocratic caste or class. Things are better in free countries, where equality before the law is a more enshrined and valued concept. But can anyone dispute that wealth, power, influence, race, and perhaps most of all, celebrity, can contribute to a kind of informal aristocracy or nobility? Certainly, everyone can see the disparities. There may be nothing on the books that says police should cut a Kennedy or a Kardashian a break, but that doesn't mean they don't get one. There's also the simple fact that there's a natural human tendency to defer to people with higher status, whether it's earned or unearned. This is neither good nor bad. What matters is why the person being deferred to has status. In other words, it's natural and normal to have elites. And contrary to the populist mood in America and much of the West right now, there is nothing inherently bad about an elite. Like Jefferson's natural aristocracy, most of us respect people who achieve great things in their pursuit of excellence. We admire elite athletes and elite soldiers. No one wants to be operated on by a particularly average heart surgeon. Culturally, it is only when elites become synonymous with people who practice elitism, i.e. snobbery, that America's rebellious DNA kicks in. Similarly, in politics and economics, our problem with elitism stems from a suspicion that the ruling classes are operating in their own self-interest, not ours. This healthy suspicion can always grow unhealthy and conspiratorial, and both the left and the right have their own versions of anti-ruling class paranoia. But it remains the case that every large complex society has elites. Indeed, every organization of even modest size does as well. The German sociologist Robert Michels coined the term the Iron Law of Oligarchy, which holds that all organizations, including those expressly committed to advancing democracy, inevitably become ruled by an elite few. A small organization, a business, a political party, or even a society like a tribe or a band, can make decisions largely by consensus. But as organizations grow in size, it becomes increasingly difficult to manage decision-making inclusively. Thus the irony of the Iron Law. It only kicks in when the cause is sufficiently attractive to large numbers of people. A fire team in the U.S. Army can largely work without much hierarchy, but an army cannot. Members of the group specialize in all sorts of ways, including in the realm of leadership and management. These leaders and managers, i.e. elites, emerge within even the most collaborative or consensual organizations, or the organizations simply fall apart under their own weight. The elites take on more responsibilities and in the process gain power and expand their access to special knowledge about how the organization works, what Michels calls administrative secrets. They can use these secrets to elevate their status and consolidate their power even further by allocating resources to reward allies and punish foes. Michels' study focused on, of all things, democratic socialist labor unions, drawing on his own experience in the German Socialist Party. But his insight is applicable to every sphere of human activity that requires a division of labor. Have you ever belonged to an even modest-sized voluntary organization or club where the bulk of the responsibilities didn't end up falling to a handful of people? What is true of charity drives, high school yearbooks, and peewee soccer leagues is also true of civilizations. The moment we move from small bands or troops of hunter-gatherers to large agricultural societies, elites in the form of ruling classes were inevitable. If elites are inevitable in every society and organization, it becomes silly to fret over the existence of elites. This is particularly true in free societies where people are permitted to pursue happiness as they define it. Not everyone wants to be rich or a politician or a military leader, but some people do. And those who want something the most are always more likely to get it than people who do not want that thing at all. To fret about political, social, or economic inequality in a free society is to fret about the problem of freedom itself. For in the presence of freedom, there will always be inequality of some kind. So the relevant question is not, how can we avoid elites, but what kind of elites shall we have? Following that, how do we keep them accountable to the rule of law and prevent them from acting in their self-interest in a way that is contrary to law, liberty, or the common good? The last 300 years offer plenty of examples of countries that transition to formal democracy only to see it eroded away by a populist tide or yanked out by ambitious elites. But the founders had other examples in mind. England under Cromwell and the dissolution of the Roman Republic loomed large in their historical memory. And so did the great commercial republic of Venice. In 1171, Venice established the Great Council, which was made up of aristocrats, but also prominent businessmen, magistrates, and other state officials. The Great Council was remarkable in its time for several reasons. It was republican, i.e. the leaders were representative of the people. Every year, 100 people were nominated to join the council. The members of the nominating committee were chosen by lot to avoid corruption of the process. This not only helped bring in fresh blood to the council, but also created legitimacy among newly wealthy merchants. The Great Council, through various mechanisms, also created one of the first systems of checks and balances and divided government. It chose the Doge, or chief magistrate of Venice, and required the Doge to accept limits to his authority. In their book, Why Nations Fail, The Origins of Power, Prosperity, and Poverty, Darren Acemoglu and James A. Robinson write, "These political reforms led to a further series of institutional innovations in law, the creation of independent magistrates, courts, a court of appeals, and new private contract and bankruptcy laws. These new Venetian economic institutions allowed the creation of new legal business forms and new types of contracts. There was rapid financial innovation, and we see the beginnings of modern banking around this time. The dynamic moving Venice towards full inclusive institutions looked unstoppable." Until it stopped! Venice's economic boom, supported by the inclusive Venetian institutions, was also accompanied by creative destruction. Each new wave of enterprising young men who became rich via the commenda, an early form of joint stock company, or other similar economic institutions, tended to reduce the profits and economic success of established elites. And they did not just reduce their profits, they also challenged their political power. By 1286, the existing elites had had enough. They implemented a law that membership in the council would henceforth be hereditary. By 1297, the council had effectively rendered itself closed to outsiders. The council soon created the Libro d'Oro, or Gold Book, which listed the recognized members of the Venetian nobility. If you weren't in the book, you could not be a member of the council. If you or your parents or grandparents were in the book and had been a member of the council, you were automatically in. Term limits on service were eliminated as well. In short, the council became a permanent and hereditary aristocracy, whereas it had once been an institution advancing republicanism and merit. This was the serrata, meaning closure or lockout. Having closed off politics from upstarts, the council soon set off to close off the economy from upstarts as well. They banned the commenda and other economic innovations that made it possible for entrepreneurs of low birth to get rich. By 1314, the Venetian state began nationalizing, i.e. socializing, trade for the benefit of the elites. Trade was heavily taxed. Long-distance trade became the preserve of the nobility. This was the beginning of the end of Venetian prosperity, writes Acemoglu and Robinson. With the main lines of business monopolized by the increasingly narrow elite, the decline was underway. Venice appeared to have been on the brink of becoming the world's first inclusive society, but it fell to a coup. The founders knew this history well. They understood that people were always going to form factions and that there will always be elites. The trick was to prevent any faction, including a majority of the people, from commandeering the state for its own ambitions. The only remedy to the problem of majoritarian factions taking over the government and bending it to its will, James Madison wrote, is to enlarge the sphere and thereby divide the community into so great a number of interests and parties that, in the first place, a majority will not be likely, at the same moment, to have a common interest separate from that of the whole or of the minority. And in the second place, that in case they should have such an interest, they may not be so apt to unite in the pursuit of it. Madison's confidence in enlarging the sphere was rewarded throughout the 19th century. The U.S. population went from just over 5 million in 1800 to 76 million in 1900. And even as the population grew fivefold, per capita GDP more than tripled. Physically, America had conquered the entire territory that would become the lower 48, though a few territories would have to wait until the early 20th century to become states. Whole cities, Chicago, Denver, St. Louis, grew from trading posts at best into teeming metropolises. Hundreds of new colleges sprung up, most of them outside the Atlantic coast. And the American idea expanded too. The slaves were freed. The franchise expanded, even to women in a few western upstarts like the Wyoming Territory in 1869 and Utah, where it was passed in the Utah Territory in 1870, repealed by Congress in 1887, and restored upon achieving statehood in 1895-96. Material prosperity combined with political liberty fostered and deepened America's culture of freedom. And in such an environment, it was inevitable that great fortunes would be made. Men with names like Getty and Rockefeller, Vanderbilt and Gould built businesses from scratch. These economic titans were not investors, but entrepreneurs. They created new products and services or new means of producing old ones on a massive, cost-reducing scale that made former luxuries into affordable creature comforts. On the whole, these wealth creators differed from the old aristocrats of feudal Europe, whose wealth depended on exploitation of the poor. The new magnates made their money by helping the poor. Cotton magnate Edward Atkinson spelled it out. Through competition among capitalists, he wrote, capital itself is every year more effective in production and tends ever to increasing abundance. Under its working, the commodities that have been the luxuries of one generation become the comforts of the next and the necessities of the third. The plane of what constitutes a comfortable subsistence is constantly rising, and as the years go by, greater and greater numbers attain this plane. Addressing some workers in 1886, Atkinson tried to explain how everyone gained from a free market. Cornelius Vanderbilt, Atkinson observed, made a profit of 14 cents from every barrel of flour shipped over his railroads. His efficiency lowered the price of flour for consumers. Did Vanderbilt keep any of you down? Challenged Atkinson, by saving you $2.75 on a barrel of flour while he was making 14 cents? The poor benefited in more direct ways as well. Just drive around the country and count the number of libraries, schools, museums, and parks that would not exist but for the largesse of the supposedly predatory wealthy. Without the Morgans, Carnegies, Gettys, Rockefellers, Goulds, and Vanderbilts, few of the truly great cultural institutions we take for granted would be standing today. Carnegie poured millions of dollars into public libraries across the country in the Jeffersonian spirit of providing ladders within reach upon which the aspiring can rise. The German sociologist Werner Sombart famously asked, "Why is there no socialism in the United States?" The answer for historians and political theorists has always been because America has no feudal past. In Europe and everywhere else, feudal class differences were embedded in notions of wealth and status. The wealthy were aristocrats and the aristocrats were wealthy. The founders sought to create a new nation where these long married categories were divorced from one another. From the time of the founding until the early 20th century, the natural tendency of the haves to form new aristocracies and guilds was held largely in check. This tendency was held at bay thanks to a number of factors. First, economic growth was just too robust. Guilds thrive in more abundant economies where competing innovators lack access to capital. Second, the nation itself was too large, too mobile, and too diverse. An established widget manufacturer in Pennsylvania might have had the kind of political clout close to home to thwart competition in his own backyard. But he was powerless to reach into Illinois or Colorado or California. A competing widget manufacturer with a better method in, say, Denver, had access to local capital, natural resources, and markets all its own. A third vital reason. the Constitution was still functioning largely as designed. Local powers could not establish interstate tariffs or other trade barriers preventing new products from rolling across the borders in train cars. Fourth, and relatedly, the state simply wasn't big enough or intrusive enough to pick winners and losers consistently, although the railroad industry might be a notable exception here. Even if regulators could be captured by established industries, there simply weren't enough of them, nor were they sufficiently powerful to block startup industries. And finally, the American culture itself was simply too powerful. Call it the yeoman spirit, or the Horatio Alger ethic, or the legacy of Puritanism, or the new bourgeois ideology sweeping the world, or simply the American dream. But the American people believed in the nobility of entrepreneurialism. And because Americans believed in it, foreigners who believed in it as well flocked to this country by the millions, carrying with them the expectation that the sky was the limit. Barring one man's ability to make his own fortune was rightly recognized as a threat to every man's right to try for the same thing. In short, America had a functioning government, but it did not have a state. No doubt this sounds odd, but it's an important distinction. Throughout the 19th century and well into the 20th, historian William Luchtenberg observes, America had almost no institutional structure to which Europeans would accord the term the state. Of course, America had a government, but that is not the same thing as the state. In political science, the difference between the state and the government is a technical one. The state includes all of the population and its territory and is permanent, while governments may come and go. For instance, France had five republics, but there has always been the French state. In the UK, the prime minister is the head of government, but the monarch is the head of state. However, this is not the distinction that is relevant here. Among conservatives and some libertarians, the distinction between the government and the state is fairly clear, if rarely articulated. The Constitution creates a government along Lockean lines, an institution designed to protect the liberties of the people. It is the product of a social contract that recognizes natural rights are prior to the government. The government, by this definition, has no right to violate the rights of the people or any individual person, save perhaps in extreme and extraordinary circumstances. The state, however, is an all-inclusive institution that has rights and interests that must come first. For such thinkers as Albert J. Nock and Franz Oppenheimer, the state was founded in oppression and conquest, i.e., the stationary bandit model discussed earlier, and is thus a much older phenomenon than government. For a libertarian like Nock, it was easy to talk about how the state is an enemy, but government is a necessary good. The nature and intention of government are social. Based on the idea of natural rights, government secures those rights to the individual by strictly negative intervention, making justice costless and easy of access. And beyond that, it does not go, Nock writes. The state, on the other hand, both in its genesis and by its primary intention, is purely antisocial. It is not based on the idea of natural rights, but on the idea that the individual has no rights except those that the state may provisionally grant him. It has always made justice costly and difficult of access, and has invariably held itself above justice and common morality whenever it could advantage itself by so doing. One doesn't have to buy Knox's view that the state is no better than a criminal enterprise, however. That's certainly not how statists themselves see it. Statists, who never go by that term, preferring progressive or liberal, or in more extreme forms, Marxist, subscribe to the French Enlightenment view of the state as an active participant in guiding the direction of society. Government is the stuff of the English garden discussed earlier. The state is a guiding hand of the French garden. Politically, culturally, and philosophically, the idea of a powerful and intrusive state rests on various versions of the general will and nationalistic arguments. The state should reflect the values and nature of the people as a whole. So, if the people collectively do not want, say, democracy or capitalism or free speech, it's fine for the state to ban such things, because the state is the fullest and most natural expression of the authentic will of the people. Every dictatorship rests on an argument that follows this basic form. But so do plenty of social democracies, which maintain many liberties while curtailing others, mostly economic ones. The idea that the state should go to great lengths to stamp out income inequality, for example, is wholly consistent with statism in the tradition of Rousseau, but antithetical to the idea of government in the tradition of Locke. Throughout Europe, where the monarchy has been both a religious and a civil institution, guiding and directing the people for thousands of years, it seemed only natural that the modern state would continue intervening in the lives of the people. In America, this was a foreign concept. Indeed, it was a concept we fought a revolution to overthrow. Many, probably most historians, locate the birth of the state in America in the New Deal. And that is largely true in the sense that the New Deal made the state a permanent fixture of American life. Before the New Deal, observed the late economist Edward M. Bernstein, a prominent member of FDR's Treasury Department, the only business a citizen had with the government was through the post office. No doubt he saw a soldier or a sailor now and then, but the government had nothing to do with the general public. After Roosevelt, the public felt that the government was then an active part of everyday life. But the truth is, the birth of the state begins a little earlier, during the Progressive Era, specifically in the Democratic administration immediately prior to FDR's, and one Roosevelt himself served in. In the next chapter, we will look at the rebirth of the state and what should properly be understood as the Second American Revolution. 8. The Progressive Era, the birth of the Living Constitution, and the death of liberty. The incredible explosion of wealth in the United States, complete with a supposedly new economic ruling class, aroused profound unease. Millions of Americans had left their rural agrarian hometowns and poured into cities. Cut off from traditional communities and let loose in the world of capitalism, they felt exploited and alienated, cast adrift in a world of strangers. And even though common people were indeed getting richer and forming new, vibrant communities, one can only sympathize with the sense of vertigo they must have felt. Capitalism seemed all too chaotic, disorganized, unfulfilling, and at times cruel for those lacking in financial or social capital. Nostalgia, homesickness for an imagined time of security and spiritual comfort was in the air. The philosophy of individualism was too small to give meaning or the sense of belonging so many yearned for. And while they struggled for security as much as wealth, the ruling classes seemed to be unjustly rich in both. A new group of American philosophers emerged, arguing, much as Rousseau had, that there has to be a better way. America needed a new imagined community bound together by a new civic religion, which, like Rousseau's, claimed to be Christian in form, but was really nationalistic and Spartan in substance. The task for these self-anointed philosophers, these new priests of modernity, was to refound America on new principles that, if put into action, would create a new society that would fill the holes in the American soul. These American philosophers were a diverse lot, but they are best lumped together under the banner of progressivism. And while not all progressives were hostile to every feature of the American order, as a group, their goal was to discredit and replace that order with a new one. Princeton historian Thomas C. Leonard identifies two core assumptions of progressive intellectuals. First, modern government should be guided by science and not politics. And second, an industrialized economy should be supervised, investigated, and regulated by the visible hand of a modern administrative state. If the original founders were products of the Scottish Enlightenment, the new founders were products of the new German Renaissance, the awakening of German social science. Many of the American sociologists, philosophers, and economists who created their fields and schools of thought in America had attended German universities or studied under those who had. When the American Economic Association was formed in 1885, five of the first six officers had studied in Germany. At least 20 of its first 26 presidents had as well. In 1906, a professor at Yale polled the top 116 economists and social scientists in America. More than half had studied in Germany for at least a year. In the 19th century, German air was thick with Marx, Hegel, and Herder. All of these thinkers fed into the broader worldview known as the historical school. Devotees believed that all economic facts are relative and evolutionary, contingent upon their time and place. Descendants of German Romanticism, they saw the state as an expression of the spirit of the people, the Volksgemeinschaft. And, in turn, they believed the state had not only a right, but an obligation to forge a new general will. Richard T. Elley, the first president of the American Economic Association and the founder of the Wisconsin School of Progressivism, which served as a kind of think tank for the progressive era in the first third of the 20th century, earned his Ph.D. at the University of Heidelberg under the historical economist Carl Kneese. The most fundamental things in our minds, he recalled of his generation of intellectuals, were on the one hand the idea of evolution, and on the other hand the idea of relativity. And men like Elley would use these ideas to wage unremitting war on capitalism. Indeed, the most vital ingredient in this German intellectual cocktail was Darwinism. Darwin's theory of evolution injected a new scientific credibility into the old anti-Enlightenment philosophies of nationalism and identity. Darwinism not only made biological racism possible, it also dealt a devastating blow to notions of natural rights while breathing new life into the idea that the state was not just an expression of the people, but should also guide the continued evolution of society. The idea was that the nation and the state and all of the institutions within it were part of a single organic whole, evolving together with the state serving as the brain, controlling and regulating all the other organs. Individuals were little more than cells in the body politic. Herbert Croly, the founder of the New Republic, said society was just an enlarged individual. Edward Ellsworth Ross, possibly the most influential sociologist of his day, believed society is a living thing actuated like all the higher creatures by the instinct for self-preservation. The chaos of capitalism was antithetical to this vision. Organs cannot compete against each other. They must work in harmony. I don't want to make it sound like American statism began as a mental virus that escaped from some German laboratory. American intellectuals made their own original contributions as well. The two most important were the social gospel, a novel reinterpretation of an ancient interpretation of Christianity, and eugenics, the belief that weeds of the unfit had to be pruned and plucked by the state. In an echo of Rousseau, the social gospel held that spiritual redemption was, or must now be, a collective enterprise. Saving souls retail was a fool's errand. The state, according to Elley, was a moral person. But the state was also God's divine instrument. God works through the state in carrying out his purposes more universally than through any other institution, Ellie wrote. It takes the first place among his instrumentalities. Social gospel preacher Samuel Zane Batten thought that one of the most pressing questions of his time was, would the state become the medium through which the people shall cooperate in their search for the kingdom of God and its righteousness? He hoped it would. And the essential task in the pursuit of social righteousness was the war on capitalism and doctrines of individualism. Our disorganized competitive life must pass into an organic cooperative life, Walter Rauschenbusch, the leading social gospel preacher and intellectual of his time, insisted. Unless the ideal social order can supply men with food, warmth, and comfort more efficiently than our present economic order, back we shall go to capitalism. Such an eventuality was unthinkable. So he proclaimed, the God that answereth by low food prices, let him be God. Without this theological backdrop, eugenics could never have caught on. Telling the full story of eugenics in America would take us too far afield. Suffice it to say that eugenics was seen at the time as cutting-edge science, and there was a large, if not total, consensus that weeding the garden of humanity of the unfit was essential to social progress. In The Promise of American Life, the Bible of American Progressivism, Herbert Croly insisted that the state had an obligation to interfere on behalf of the really fittest. Richard Ellie insisted that progressives must acknowledge the superiority of man's selection to nature's selection. Letting free people reproduce freely, presumably an integral part of the pursuit of happiness, was folly. Such freedom is just too likely to give us unfit men. But a society guided by the expert hands of science gives us the ideal man, he explained. The great word is no longer natural selection, but social selection. While I've focused on the roles of America and Germany, it should be noted that the ideas of the progressive era were truly part of a transnational intellectual awakening. For instance, positivism, a widely held philosophy largely invented by the Frenchman Auguste Comte, held that society had entered the third stage of history, the age of science. Essentially picking up where Condorcet had left off, Comte believed that human society could be directed, guided, and ultimately perfected by enlightened experts. That project, by its nature, would have to be collectivist in outlook. He called individualism the disease of the Western world. Comte coined the term sociology and helped create the discipline to achieve this end. Later, he created a wholly secular religion of humanity in which men of science would be the new saints. When Herbert Croly was born in 1869, his parents literally baptized him into Comte's religion of humanity. Still, on a practical level, the influence of Germany, specifically Prussia, was especially significant because it was seen as a real-world example of how politics should work. It helped fuel a deep contempt for traditional notions of democracy. Prussia, where so many progressives had studied, at the end of the 19th century had been ruled by Otto von Bismarck, the authoritarian Iron Chancellor, who introduced what was then called top-down socialism, run by professional civil servants. Bismarck's Prussia was seen as state-of-the-art in governance by a new generation of American academics. One such academic, who studied under Ellie and who was granted one of the first PhDs from the new Johns Hopkins University, the first major German-style research university in America, was Woodrow Wilson. He would later write that Bismarck's Prussia was an admirable system and the most studied and most nearly perfected in the world. In the 1880s, Wilson had argued that the most despotic of governments under the control of wise statesmen is preferable to the freest ruled by demagogues. Alas, America was a democracy. And to counter that, Wilson wanted to limit the error of trying to do too much by vote, by walling off as much policymaking from the court of public opinion as possible. Let administrative study find the best means for giving public criticism this control and for shutting it out from all other interference. After all, he explained, self-government does not consist in having a hand in everything any more than housekeeping consists necessarily in cooking dinner with one's own hands. The cook must be trusted with a large discretion as to the management of the fires and the ovens. Give us administrative elasticity and discretion, Woodrow Wilson wrote in 1891. Free us from the idea that checks and balances are to be carried down through all stages of organization. It is difficult to exaggerate Wilson's arrogant and sovereign contempt for the system set up by the founders. The reformer is bewildered, he whined, by the need to persuade a voting majority of several million heads. Elsewhere, he scoffed, no doubt a lot of nonsense has been talked about the inalienable rights of the individual, and a great deal that was mere vague sentiment and pleasing speculation has been put forward as fundamental principle. Wilson's view on democracy and the Constitution were relatively tame compared to those of many of his peers, but they capture the essential spirit of the progressive outlook. Woodrow Wilson depended heavily on Darwin to argue for throwing the Constitution in the dustbin. He wrote, "The Constitution was founded on the law of gravitation. The government was to exist and move by virtue of the efficacy of checks and balances. The trouble with the theory is that government is not a machine, but a living thing. It falls not under the theory of the universe, but under the theory of organic life. It is accountable to Darwin, not to Newton. It is modified by its environment, necessitated by its tasks, shaped to its functions by the sheer pressure of life. No living thing can have its organs offset against each other as checks and live." Thus, for all practical purposes, was the insidious American cult of the living constitution born. "Living political constitutions," Wilson wrote, "must be Darwinian in structure and in practice. Society is a living organism and must obey the laws of life, not of mechanics. It must develop." Contempt for the founding became the hallmark of sophistication. The philosopher John Dewey, the most important philosopher of the progressive era, argued that the folly of the founders lay in their belief that their principles would or should outlive their time. In Liberalism and Social Action, 1935, Dewey argued the founders lacked historic sense and interest. The Lockean ideal of government merely protecting the rights of the citizens and otherwise leaving the people alone was antiquated codswallop. Even the idea of individual rights was a bygone relic. "Natural rights and natural liberties exist only in the kingdom of mythological social zoology," Dewey argued. "Rights can only be properly secured through social control of economic forces in the interest of the great mass of individuals." Humans were nothing in themselves for Dewey. The general will was everything. "Social expediency rather than natural right," argued Frank J. Goodnow, the first president of the American Political Science Association and a hugely influential professor of administrative law at Columbia University, "must determine the sphere of individual freedom of action. Changed conditions," he added, "must bring in their train different conceptions of private rights if society is to be advantageously carried on. These views were no doubt sincerely held. But the supposedly disinterested experts and intellectuals who pushed them had an interest in doing so. They weren't merely arguing in the abstract that experts